Wednesday morning out there. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this is the Kenai Conversation. We do have a winter weather advisory in effect today until 10 p.m. for snow and gusting winds. Snow accumulation could be up to 6 inches, expected to be heaviest around Kenai and Nikiski, so please be careful out driving around today. I feel like we are in excellent hands today, though, for a winter weather emergency, as we have two gentlemen from the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management in the studio today. We've got Dan Nelson, who's the OEM director. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Thanks, Jenny. Good morning.
And we have Bud Sexton, who is the whole community planner, and we're going to get to what that means in a minute. But for the moment, hi, Bud.
Good morning, Jenny. Thanks for having us.
So if there is some sort of snow emergency, I feel like we, at least in this room, are going to be safe, unless you guys have to, you get a bat phone signal and have to run off somewhere and deal with something.
Well, hopefully not. We'll do good here. Good first snow. We'll take it this season.
Okay. So we don't actually have you here just because we're nervous about snow. Today's topic is emergency response and emergency planning in general. But the impetus for this is it is November 27th, which is a mere 3 days away from November 30th, which, as I'm sure we all remember who were around a year ago on November 30th, it's the anniversary of an earthquake. Dan, refresh our memories. So at 8:36 a.m., I want to say?
About that? Yeah, absolutely. So I think most of us will remember that it definitely woke us up, if you weren't already, on a Friday morning at about 8:30, and 7.1 earthquake. So now here on the Kenai Peninsula, we really didn't have as much of an impact as we saw with Anchorage, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, but it definitely was a wake-up call for us. If depending where you were that day, if you were in some of our coastal areas, such as Homer or Seward, you had a tsunami warning, so we were getting people out of low-lying areas. But really, after that cleared, luckily with no resulting tsunami, but you know, we had some damage. We had some impacts. We were talking about the North Road here this morning. If you remember driving through there, quite a bit of time it took to repair that, I'll say. But, you know, relatively minor impacts. But really, as we talk about this one-year anniversary, it's really a good time to kind of reflect on that and realize that Alaska is sort of a dangerous place. We all love it here, but you know, there's a lot of risk and hazard to it. So a good time to reflect on maybe what we've done and where we need to go.
So walk us through the day at OEM when something like the earthquake happens. Let's use the earthquake for an example. What is your process? What are your priorities? How are you getting the word out and keeping people safe?
Sure. So for folks that don't know, OEM, or the Office of Emergency Management, is a borough function. And what we do is we basically have the local authority for managing emergencies and disasters on the peninsula. And that's for everything in the unincorporated area. Cities have their own disaster management, but we support them as well, and especially when they have needs that are a little bit greater than an individual city can provide. So what we do is focus primarily on life safety. So some of the things that we coordinate is all the public alert and warning. So if we talk about the tsunami warning that happened on November 30th a year ago, that's running those sirens. That's one of the warning systems that many of us got a notification on our cell phone. Those types of systems we manage. So getting that out and then making sure the cities and those low-lying areas, as well as the villages that had that tsunami warning, were got the word, we're evacuating folks or doing what they need to do. So that's always our first priority. So one of the big things with OEM is information. And that's something that's been seen a lot this year as we've done various things. So we'll stand up our team. We've got some staff we pull from other departments within the borough that have been specially trained, get them together and figure out what the situation is. So for November 30th, luckily, once we were done with the life safety aspect for a few hours, we'll get into things such as damage assessment, figuring out what we need to do to get things back to normal.
And there's a lot of different agencies involved in that as well, right? DOT is kind of the big one. Checking out bridges is one of the first priorities. But other transportation, you know, airports and docks and things like that get pretty high priority.
Absolutely. Pretty much anything of what we call critical infrastructure. So DOT was out there nearly immediately checking roads and bridges, of course. All of the schools and the school staff were doing the same thing with our public facilities. But pretty much airports, transportation, communications, energy, you know, so our local energy facilities, those all get checked fairly quickly. So the goal is to make sure that if there is any disruption to anything we have, really that we rely on in daily life, we check that and are able to mitigate that quickly with those partners.
And there was damage. I mean, obviously not as dramatic as you saw in Anchorage and Mat-Su area. Luckily for us, nothing as dramatic as that. But you were just reminding me that there are still some ongoing repairs that need to be done around the borough.
Yeah, we are still working on things. So there were some school facilities and public facilities that the borough owned that had some damage. You know, most of those were taken care of the day of or quickly soon after, some leaks and things like that. But more in the Nikiski area, so there's some damage still out at the North Peninsula Community Center, the old elementary school. There's a few schools. There's one in Kenai, Skyview, and Soldotna have damage that still needs to be repaired. So between that, some minor road issues for borough roads. Of course, the DOT had some damage up in Anchorage and just the North Road here that we could see. So even though it wasn't really, it wasn't something that was really on the top of folks' minds, it is still something that we're dealing with and getting repaired.
Yeah, I think a lot of us probably have some new cracks around our houses that we could tag with that particular earthquake.
Absolutely. I know I do.
Yep. Well, we all probably have cracks for various reasons in our houses because it's Alaska, but at least we know what to blame those particular ones on.
Absolutely. So a lot, really a lot went down, and what we try and do, of course, is improve after every one of those things. We looked for some of the lessons learned and some of the improvements we can make, and that had mostly to do with communications and warning and coordination with all those various departments and entities that you alluded to earlier, whether it be state, local, or federal. So that really is a lot of OEM's job, is that coordination piece, keeping all those pieces in the air, making sure everybody's singing from the same sheet of music, and we've got a cohesive plan to make sure that people are safe, because that's really what our mission is at the end of the day, is public safety.
The communication aspect, just from a media person who's kind of watched things evolve at OEM and how you communicate and how much you communicate and how often you communicate, it's been really interesting to see the growth in that. And Bud, you've been a public information officer as well, so you can probably speak to this too. What maybe changed with the earthquake? Were you trying anything new then, or how did things develop? I know you've got the phone, you get text messages, of course you keep the Facebook page updated, you guys have a great website.
You know, and with that earthquake, one of the things that happened that was new was something called wireless emergency alerts. And so similar to the text messages that we do send out, that was one, even the folks here on the Central Peninsula got that push notification. It was a different notification than your text that talked about the tsunami warning. Now, here in the Central Peninsula, we don't have a tsunami danger, but the way that technology worked at the time, which they're now rolling out some changes, we really had no choice but to send that out to the entire Kenai Peninsula. But that was really the first time we've live used that system, which is based on, you know, where your cell phone actually is, based on towers rather than a text message. So that was a new thing that we're trying to get refined as we go. That's a federal system, so you know the input we have at the local level is limited, but I think Bud can definitely talk a little bit about we're trying to change to meet the expectations of the public in kind of a new social media age.
Exactly. And Jenny, as you alluded to, you know, information is probably one of the biggest things people have need of during a disaster, whether it's a Swan Lake fire. And, you know, there's a few different things that OEM is very much involved with. We have a blog, which is at KPB, which is for Kenai Peninsula Borough, OEM.com. So KPBOEM.com. And that's a blog where it's like a virtual joint information center. So basically what that means, a joint information center is anyone who has a piece of the pie. So for Swan Lake, that was the fire incident management team. It was the refuge. As we got closer to school time than the school district. So lots of different agencies and departments have the ability to post directly to that page. So for individuals who are really looking for information from a lot of different agencies, either you can go directly to each one of those pages or those sites. But that blog is a one-stop shop for people to be able to see the information from a variety of different sources. And so we saw that blog used very heavily during the summertime. There's a lot of different things that were going on. So I think it was probably some statistics of pretty much close to about 500,000 page views over the course of the summer. The borough had a call center, which probably over about a 2 or 3 week period of time, we had over 5,100 calls from the public and from travelers. A lot of that was, you know, what's going on right now with the road system, you know, where things are open. That highway definitely impacted a lot of people in a variety of different ways. Of course, you know, for people that have medical concerns, there's oftentimes, well, they'll go up to Anchorage, you know, for different medical appointments and back and forth. And so as we know, you know, one road in, one road out, there are a lot of difficulties that transpire when, you know, things are delayed for a period of time.
And there are a lot of cooks in that kitchen then, all the different agencies that are involved and different people bringing in information. So is there an Uber editor? Is there someone who's just making sure all the information is jibing together? For instance, Dan, you mentioned that push notification about the tsunami warning, which went to folks in the Kenai area who lived on the bluff. And all of a sudden they're going, wait a second, I didn't think that was a thing. Is this a thing? And the borough obviously had some great information immediately letting folks know, no, Kenai is going to be okay. But when you don't necessarily always have control over what information is getting out there, what's your response to that? That probably makes your job a little more difficult.
It's a challenge because now in the social media age that I alluded to, you know, there's information out there that, you know, we really don't know where it came from. And that virtual Joint Information Center, that website, and then kind of the companion KPB Alerts, Facebook, and Twitter that we maintain is designed to have that legitimate information, that verified information. So when we talk about, you know, what information we do, we really are kind of vetting which cooks are in the kitchen. So what that means is our agencies that have an involvement, only those agencies and their specific spokespeople or public information officers or those elected, you know, those officials are able to get that information out. And by doing that, we make sure that the information we put out is accurate. It's the most timely that we can be, you know, and sometimes people will say, well, you know, I heard this and it turned out to be true. Why weren't you saying that? And we go through a pretty rigorous process of trying to vet that information, make sure it's accurate before it goes out. So a lot of times we will also watch some of that information and try and track down, let's say somebody posts on a social media site some fact about the earthquake and, well, we hadn't heard that. Let's see if we can verify that through our channels before we're going to repeat something like that or before we put something out that says, well, that's not accurate. Here's what's really going on. So it is a difficult thing because we're all used to getting our smartphones out. We're used to getting instant information. But some of the reason that maybe our information, I don't want to say is a little bit slower, but we're going to be a little bit more deliberate in putting it out. But also we've really changed kind of how we've done things over the years. 15, 20 years ago, we used to talk at emergency management, well, we'll put a news release out twice a day, and that's we'll get that to the radio station, the TV station, and that'll be good. Well, that's not how it works anymore. So we all have that instant need for information. We have the technology to do it, so it's up to us to rise to meet that challenge, and it is a challenge from time to time.
And what kind of personnel do you have in that incident command room? I understand there's a volunteer base now as well who just helps with the social media and helps with keeping track of information.
There's a couple different resources we have. So our OEM office has four people in it. So we have four positions that are full-time that do nothing but work on emergency management. The borough then maintains its incident management team, which is separate from the OEM office, although we run it where people that might work in other departments within the borough get special training, they come in and help us manage, because four people, obviously, for something like an earthquake or Swan Lake fire isn't going to do it. But we also do have that volunteer corps. So we have a formal volunteer program called CERT, Community Emergency Response Team. And from those ranks and from some other folks, we also use volunteers to get some of that information. So if you happen to call us at our 262 info number during the summer, chances are you were probably talking to your neighbor. You were talking to a volunteer that just wanted to help and provide information. So there's some great ways to actually volunteer, and we're looking constantly at new ways to incorporate both individual volunteers as well as other organizations. And that's a little bit about the whole community initiative you alluded to at the beginning. So there's quite a bit of opportunity there, and we use volunteers the best we can because we know, if you're calling and you're talking to somebody, you want to talk to your neighbor. You want to talk to a local person. They're getting the right information from the same sources that we use to get information out. But it's much more personal and really much more effective.
You know, in fact, so many times when people were calling the call center during the summertime, very often would we hear the comment of, wow, I didn't know I was going to get a live person. You know, and where are you guys actually located? Well, we're located in Soldotna. Okay, well, you know, we know exactly, you know, where they're located. We know the issues that they're facing because we're local. And so that was a big deal. And when you talk about, you know, how do we coordinate some of the different information? And so, for instance, with a public information officer team that was involved out of OEM and in the borough, that group coordinated not only the call center, but the social media component, including the blog and Facebook. All these different pieces were definitely out of the same area. So that way we can make sure, no matter where somebody prefers to get their information, for some people, that's Facebook. For some people, they prefer having a live person just, you know, really cut between the lines and really just kind of tell them, you know, in a soundbite or a simple conversation, what's going on. For some people, that's a blog because they want to go and research their own information and, you know, and their own methods. And so it's really trying to meet people wherever they are. And that's a big component of what we do is provide information, no matter what the situation is.
And that is Bud Sexton, who is the whole community planner at the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management. We also have Dan Nelson, who's the OEM director in the studio today. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and we're talking emergency management today. And we can take calls if anyone has questions for our OEM guest today. The phone number is 283-8414. So before we leave the earthquake, what went well from your standpoint and what maybe lessons did you learn that you took forward from that particular experience?
You know, I think what really went well, which is certainly a testament to the community and to the first responders, is, you know, in the immediate aftermath of that earthquake, the biggest life threat we had was our potential tsunami warning. And even though that didn't affect us here in the Central Peninsula, we were working with Seward and Homer, Seldovia, the villages across Kachemak Bay, and every one of those folks followed directions of their first responders, of law enforcement, firefighters, got out of the spit, got out of the harbor, got to safe ground, and we basically made sure without much effort, by just community effort, that those places, people had a place to go, that the students were kept safe. Remember, this was 8:30 in the morning, school was in session. If you might remember our last earthquake in January of 2018, it was at 12:30 at night. So a little bit of a different dynamic from OEM's perspective, where we've got more people on the road, we've got more facilities in play. So all of those things went excellent as far as the coordination and the response and the actual kind of what we call boots on the ground operations. Lessons learned, some of that came from the warning that we talked about. You know, all right, I'm in the bluff in Kenai and my phone just went off. What's going on? So that has been heard. We've been trying to get the federal government and the federal systems upgraded to help us support a little bit better warning. So we have a couple different warning systems. One is that wireless emergency alerts, that push notification, and then the other is our KPB alert system, which is an opt-in system. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, before the hour's up on how to get signed up for that. So when we talk about communication, also the operational communication we have, and this is something, if you've ever been around an emergency or disaster, well, we always say it's always communications. That always comes up. But getting information quickly and timely from the National Tsunami Warning Center, which is a federal agency, through the Weather Service and the state, which all have roles in pushing that information out, and down to the local communities, whether it was the borough and then down to Homer, Seward, Seldovia, and some of the Central Peninsula communities. So that was something we definitely found could be improved. Part of that was just technology. You know, if you tried to find out what the magnitude of that earthquake was in the immediate hour or so, my chances are you probably couldn't find out because the earthquake website went down. It was overloaded with information, and we were actually getting information via an old-school telephone line where it was actually being read out. So we keep that old-school technology around for a reason, but that was definitely some some things. There was a little bit of delay in getting the warning out for sirens, which had to do with some of our federal partners. So some of those improvements were really something we're continuing to work on, and really the focus on there that we've been trying to do this year is coordination between the borough and the cities, making sure we're all on the same page. So those are the big lessons learned that we came from that. Luckily, of course, nobody was injured, nobody was killed, not too much damage. So it was a good drill, a success for us in that sense.
Yeah, I guess a silver lining to living in Alaska being a dangerous place, as you mentioned, is we have lots of opportunities to practice this stuff.
We absolutely do.
So you guys have had a busy year beyond just the earthquake. What else has been on your agenda?
So what has not happened here on the Kenai Peninsula?
Well, Godzilla, we discussed, has not yet showed up.
Let's not tempt fate today for that. So, you know, a few, we had started out, I kind of talked about, we had the earthquake last November. Right before that, we had some flooding in the Seward area, which we were dealing with, but we kind of got through the winter and dealing with some of that, and that got us right into fire season. So we all know very, very unseasonably dry, very atypical weather pattern generated just a beautiful summer by all means. But
well, until it got too smoky to appreciate.
True. Yeah, but, you know, we definitely had those issues of fires. So starting early May, we had some fires flare up kind of in a very atypically early fire season. And then, of course, the Swan Lake fire starting June 5th. On that Swan Lake fire, which, of course, was lightning caused, that went through a couple iterations. It was kind of tamped down. It wasn't growing. The weather pattern changed and, of course, caused that to rekindle. So I think everybody's pretty familiar with how they were personally affected by that fire, whether it was smoke sitting on the highway for delays and certainly understanding what was going on there. We also had a few others down in the South Peninsula, the North Fork Fire, the Caribou Lake Fire, the Bluff Drive Fire, which was the first fire here of the season that certainly had some causes there. So a big fire season. A little bit of a measles outbreak in the middle of that we helped support. And once those fires started tamping down, then we discovered we had a drought. So the peninsula was technically in a drought state or classification, but we've got two communities, Seldovia and Nanwalek, down in the Southern Peninsula that use open reservoirs. They can't use wells real effectively because the bedrock and the soil. So they have open water reservoirs that are recharged by rainwater. Not any rain for us. So there was some drinking water concerns, so starting to manage, trying to get water shipped over at several points, some conservation, some long-term effects. And luckily that was mitigated when the rain did finally come. But boy, by the time we were done with that, I think it was time for a vacation. It was it was a busy year for the Office of Emergency Management, and certainly a busy year for everybody that was dealing with that, because I think probably everybody on the peninsula was affected by at least one of those disasters in some way.
Yep. And it's, you know, we don't often think of things like the measles or a drought that you guys end up dealing with as well, but basically anything that could ruin your day is in the bailiwick of OEM.
True. Yep. And it just kind of depends what it is. And I'll admit, I didn't think I'd ever be managing a drought here in South Central Alaska. I do tell a story that I actually opened up the plan and went to see if there actually was anything listed. There was not. So we'll have to change that. But learning new things and definitely what the weather we saw this year, It threw us for a challenge. It definitely, it didn't let up the whole summer.
Well, you've got a bit of a reprieve weather-wise this fall, and early winter so far have been pretty mild. Do you have any inside knowledge on what we're looking at for the rest of it?
Probably not. You know, I don't have any particular insight. You know, we certainly monitor those changes and things, but you know, it's just a good reminder here to be careful. Let's all slow down and remember how to drive in that first snow and ice event of the year. But, you know, we'll just take it one day at a time. Hopefully the peninsula will get a bit of a reprieve this winter, and we'll hope for that and have a nice mild winter. Everybody can get out and ski and do those things and get some moisture in the system for before wildfire season hits.
You know, Jenny, I think one of the key things as we take a look at this kind of a reprieve, if you will, hopefully, you know, from emergencies and disasters, it's a good opportunity for people to look back even from November 30th from the earthquake. And if you lived in one of the coastal communities or any one of the other areas, for many people, if they did have to evacuate because they were in a tsunami inundation zone, For many of those individuals I've talked with throughout the year, they identified that, well, you know, when I had to evacuate, I didn't have a go bag ready. You know, I didn't have all of my key documents or whatever they needed, medication perhaps. They didn't have those things ready. And for many of those people, you know, they listed that as a priority of things that they should, you know, remedy and take care of. But oftentimes what's easy to do is also easy not to do. You know, while that was a priority at the time, you know, in our lives, we have so many priorities out there. And, you know, when you get beyond the earthquake for any period of time, then everything else in life takes over. And so maybe, you know, this is a good reminder for people to take a look at any of these things you've identified over the course of this past year with all these different variety of disasters that have taken place. You know, it's a good opportunity to look back and say, okay, is there something that I could have done differently? Is there something that we need to better prepare for? And that's a good focus for people. And that's one of the things we definitely want to encourage people to do. Our recommendation is for people to always have 7 to 14 days worth of supplies in your home. So that way, if the Sterling Highway is impacted for a period of time, for instance, then, you know, you don't have to worry about trying to run to the supermarket and, you know, buy whatever necessary supplies. You know, we do live in an area that has lots of emergencies. And, you know, for an emergency to take place that will impact us for a longer period of time rather than just a number of hours that the highway shut down, what if it is a number of days? You know, what would that really look like? So, you know, when we encourage people to be prepared, it is for those big disasters. And that is certainly something that it's a good reminder for people, you know, as we talk here today, you know, take a look around. You know, wintertime's approaching. What if we did have a substantial amount of snowfall that impacted electricity that was out for, you know, 24 to 48 hours, you know? What would that look like for your place? And if for some people that have CPAPs or other medical equipment that is operated by electricity, what is your backup plan? You know, so if that power is out for a considerable period of time, and just really thinking through and planning ahead, and, you know, and if you're a caregiver, you know, and you're taking care of somebody, you know, how can you make sure that the individual you're caring for has appropriate resources? So that way, when something does happen, you know what exactly how to do.
We're talking with Bud Sexton, the Whole Community Planner, and we're going to get into that next. And Dan Nelson, who is the Director of the Office of Emergency Management with the Kenai Peninsula Borough. We are going to take a quick break here at the bottom of the hour and be back to answer your questions and talk more about what we all can do for emergency planning and preparation as well. It's not just all on the Office of Emergency Management. So stay tuned. We're going to be right back. Thank you. And we're back. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and I'm in the studio today with Dan Nelson and Bud Sexton. And before I get back to them, it sounds like we've got a call. Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
All right, go ahead with your question.
Well, it's not exactly a question. It was a comment. That earthquake we had in January, it was exactly to the hour to the one we had in January a year or two before. And I don't know if you realize that or not, but like 20 minutes off is all it was. And the other thing is my truck was out of gas when we had that earthquake. It was sitting on empty, and an earthquake never entered my mind. And when I leaned forward to grab my shoes, when I realized this is going to be a good one, a bad one, it threw me sideways into my wood stove, and I had a grill mark on my hip that was third-degree burn. So that was my experience with that earthquake.
Ouch. Well, I hope you are healed up from that.
My point was I didn't have any gas in my truck. There was no way for me to go had it really been real.
Yep. Speaking of emergency planning.
Yes. Yes. So, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Oh, I'm glad you're healed up from that, and that is a great point of you just never know when these things are going to end up happening, and that's a great tip that I like to share with people. And I think a lot of people will do this here just because we're taking long winter drives, but always drive that top half of your tank, fill that tank up at half. And for our vehicles at OEM, there's actually a three-quarter rule. We fill those up once they go down three-quarter just in case. So another good just kind of everyday preparedness tip that you can use to mitigate that, because when the power goes out, if we would have had a wide power outage for that earthquake, those gas stations don't operate. They require electricity to run those gasoline pumps. So I'm glad that the experience wasn't too bad for our caller, but a really good tip there nonetheless, a lesson learned from there.
Absolutely. So that's what we're going to cover the rest of this hour is preparedness and things communities can do and individuals can do. So, Bud, that leads us to your interesting title. What are you working on?
Whole community. So what whole community really is, we've been talking already that how often emergencies and disasters happen on the Kenai Peninsula. If we were to look back over the last 15 years, there was somewhere around the neighborhood of 25 different emergencies and big disasters that have actually taken place. And so we know that living in Alaska, the things we face are pretty wide and varied. We've already talked about earthquakes. We've talked about flooding. We've talked, touched on, potential for severe winter weather and power outages. And of course, if we take a look across the inlet, we have the volcanoes. And so that was, I think, in 2009 when Mount Redoubt definitely impacted air travel. And so we know that emergencies happen. In Alaska, probably the gold standard for emergency management planning is talking about the 64 earthquake. That is the, of course, 9.2 earthquake, the biggest in North America. And, in so many places, in the lower 48 or other locations, when they talk about emergencies and disasters, they say, well, we have the potential for something to happen. In Alaska, all we have to say is it just has to happen again. So when we talk about emergency management planning, it is really identifying those things such as a 64 style earthquake. And what would that mean? So with whole community, what we're really doing is we're talking to individuals and businesses and community groups out there. So we know that in a really big disaster, people are going to come out and want to help out their neighbors, whether it's a business, whether it's a community group, people are a church group as well. Everyone's going to be looking to ask the question of what can we do to help out our neighbors? And so with whole community, what we're really doing is we're building this framework ahead of time. So that way, any of these entities I just mentioned, if you're somebody that says, we would definitely help out our community, well, those are the people we want to talk with and help incorporate them in the whole community, which is really a kind of a buzzword, a term of basically saying that we're going to build this framework ahead of time. So we are going to get those individuals and organizations and businesses and churches. We're going to line all those people up ahead of time. We're going to talk with them, sit down, have a cup of coffee. And you know, when it's real, things are calm, you know, when we have the opportunity to think and plan ahead, we're sitting down with them and identifying, you know, for a church, for instance, you know, that says we want to be able to help out our community. And so sit down with the groups and individuals and really ask them, say, okay, what would you want to do? What are the areas where you would want to help out your community and really work with them and help develop a plan so how they could do that? So when our incident management team looks at a disaster, they look how, let's say, Nikiski is affected where we are currently, or Kenai, and they say, okay, what are the entities around this disaster who have already said, we want to help? Who are those people? And so we would look at that, because if we're going to build a database ahead of time, that's what they're going to be able to do. And they're going to be able to identify what resources those organizations have, no matter what it is. For some organization, you may have a really strong volunteer base, and you have a great system, a great process already developed of how you would utilize your volunteers. And they come with, you know, 25, 30, 50 volunteers, whatever they have, or maybe 5 or 10. And they say, okay, how would we be able to help? So building all these, this framework, building this database ahead of time, the value is that way when that disaster happens, when that emergency strikes, our ability to respond and meet the needs of the community is going to be that much faster. It's going to happen that much quicker and be more efficient and effective and all these different things. And the bottom line is that our community is going to be able to get what they need in the way they need it and where they need it. And so in a nutshell, that's what whole community is all about.
Yeah, definitely in the middle of a disaster emergency situation is not where you want to be deciding, okay, who's doing what and where and how.
Exactly. But if we can figure out, you know, 60, 70, 80% of all the things that we need during a disaster, we can figure all that out ahead of time. Then that leaves a much smaller percentage that you have to figure out as you go. And, you know, with every emergency out there, everything is different. Even if we talk about wildland fire, there are so many differences out there. It all depends on where it is and how close to structures and population sources, to the highway, you know, how close resources are, how many other fires are going on at the same time. But, you know, if we're talking about earthquake, you know, where is that location? And some areas get shook more than others. And so how it affects your home. And, you know, for instance, the earthquake a few years ago, my home was affected more than the one that was just, you know, last year. And so everything is affected very differently depending on the disaster. But if we can, you know, take a look at how do we build all these resources and everything ahead of time, then it lessens the amount of things we have to try to figure out on the morning of, or the evening of, or in the middle of the night. You know, it all depends on when the disaster strikes next.
So you guys already have the CERT teams, right? The Community Emergency Response
Team.
So this sounds like maybe another level on top of that, where you're working with organizations now and other kind of larger groups and getting them in the fold and trained and ready to help respond.
Exactly. Because, you know, for instance, you know, most of our callers belong to, you know, whether they're at a business or whether they belong to a community organization or a church, you know, wherever you fall in that mix, for instances, when we talk about businesses, and traditionally, you know, perhaps we haven't always addressed businesses in the past, you know, ahead of time, like we're doing with whole community. For a business out there, you know, if you take a look at what equipment and resources and knowledge that you have, and how could that be applied during a disaster? If we talk about that 64 style earthquake, you know, what is the impact to our bridges? And there is potential for a large amount of impact. You know, you go anywhere on the peninsula, and how many bridges do you have to cross in order to be able to get to your place of employment, or get to your children's school, or get from here to Anchorage? Obviously, there's a lot more bridges that we have to cross. And if there is a 64 style quake, which disrupts it, or, you know, makes for a period of time where people can't go across the bridge, you know, for businesses that have transportation and in some of those forklifts, you know, and if, let's say the Port of Anchorage is severely damaged, for instance, what is that going to look like to reroute air cargo? And perhaps it's to Kenai. So if we get a lot of air cargo to Kenai, then It's going to be able to get those, you know, items out to various locations. So, you know, there's a lot of potential, depending on the emergency, for lots of different entities to be able to participate. But it's, you know, as we talk about doing everything ahead of time, and it's really planning, you know, as we've talked already throughout this show, it's if you're on an individual level, plan for your home. If you're a business, it's not only, you know, talking with us about planning ahead, but, you know, it's also about COOP. You know, COOP is continuity of operations plan. And I know Dan has done some different training on that as we talk about businesses. And Dan, if you want to share from a business perspective on, you know, what some of the things businesses should really have in mind.
And when we talk about that continuity of operations planning, you can really sum that down to kind of one question, which is, how do I keep my business running? And from an emergency management standpoint, what we talk about is if we keep businesses running, if we keep all of our industry, private sector, public sector, if we can keep those things going, then we're more resilient as a community. Our, you know, citizens and residents can go to work, they can still get a paycheck, commerce is still going on, the economy is still there. So when if you have a business or you have a nonprofit organization, it really doesn't matter when you're planning for this, you know, how do you keep your business functional? How do you keep your folks employed? So when we talk about things like how many of us use a cloud reader to take payments or keep all of our business information on an online service, what about when the internet goes down? What about when the power goes down? You can't get those computers, you can't get those types of things to work. So we talk about communications and technology is a big piece of it. And then we talk about facilities. So if we have that 64 earthquake, your facility is damaged, that primary facility, do you have the ability to work from home? Do you have the ability to go to an alternate facility? If you're a storefront or manufacturing something, you know, that has one set of challenges. If you're a service-based business, that has another set of challenges. So typically when we talk about that, we focus on those two things. But the overriding goal here is if we make our community more resilient, if we keep that normal pace of business going, then that's going to make us be able to recover from whatever's happening, be it an earthquake, a wildfire, or anything in between, much quicker. So when we talk about that, that's some of the things you want to talk about. There's a lot of resources out there. There's some on our website, but we really want to encourage, if you have a business, if you have an organization, you can, of course, reach out to Bud or I, and we can provide a little bit more one-on-one. But that's really the impetus is, how can you stay functioning in an emergency?
You know, one of the interesting things, they talk about statistics of emergencies and as it relates to businesses. And one of the things they talk about is that half of all employees will show up during a disaster, you know, to be able to come to work. And so, you know, for businesses, when they look at their continuity of operations plan and how are they going to exist with half of the employees? And, you know, you don't get to pick on which half show up. So is it the half who know all the protocols and systems in place, or is it the half that maybe, you know, is more of the front end style of employees? The other thing for businesses to consider is, you know, do you actually have, you know, disaster supplies in your business at your location? So if you do happen to have your employees on a typical workday and that disaster happens, you know, the earthquake shakes and now the bridge is out between that employee and their home. So number one, do you have the ability to have supplies for that business to be able to stay operational? Do you have the supplies for those employees to be able to stay there and function? And then also for those employees, do they have their own home kit prepared? So that way they know that things on the home front are, you know, well taken care of. So, you know, there's lots of potential out there on many different levels when we talk about preparation for businesses and organizations and individuals. So lots to focus on.
Yeah, so it sounds like two different things here. One, ways that OEM can help advise businesses to take care of themselves and be ready to respond in emergency situations. And then with the whole community initiative, you're also asking businesses and organizations to maybe help the rest of the community as well. So if they're going to go that route, if they feel like, all right, we've got our house in order, we've done some of this planning, and feel like we're going to be able to take care of ourselves in an emergency situation, and we would also like to participate with the rest of the community, what kinds of businesses and organizations are you looking for? Are you just hoping that anyone who is interested get in contact with you? I mean, are you restaurants, daycares, places with heavy equipment, or are there certain types of maybe facilities or services that you're more interested in maybe than others?
There's actually a wide variety of different businesses and community organizations. You know, you think about a community organization, we've talked about businesses. So if we talk about organizations out there, you know, how many have a volunteer base? You know, and what would that look like? And so one of the things when we talk to organizations out there, how do they plan for volunteers? And when we talk about volunteers during disasters, there are a couple different kinds. One is an affiliated volunteer, and that is a person who is currently a volunteer for an organization. They've already affiliated themselves with that organization. They're already knowledgeable about that organization and the processes and what and services they offer. The other part of volunteers that show up during a disaster is what we call spontaneous volunteers. Those are people who are not affiliated with a Red Cross or a Salvation Army or, you know, whatever, a Rotary or something else. And so they say, you know, I've never volunteered before and I want to volunteer because this disaster is affecting my neighbors. And so we are looking and talking with organizations and really encouraging them to plan for that process. And then the other component of, you know, how do individuals volunteer, we've already talked about that, which is the CERT program, the Community Emergency Response Team. So there's many different ways for people to be able to volunteer. And so, you know, what are the types of entities that we would look for? You know, you think about a disaster, you think about the potential for needs. And then if you have a service or equipment based or, you know, whatever you have, you know, some of these different rental places, I mean, it's really good to know all the different types of equipment they have at their disposal or that they rent out. So that way, you know, during the disaster, if when we build this electronic database and our incident management team can do a quick query, an electronic query and put in a keyword and be able to know that XYZ business has a forklift. So if we have a substantial need, you know, for that air cargo, you know, simulation that we were talking about earlier, you know, we would have a severe need for lots of heavy equipment to be able to move and offload cargo. And so if you have a business that has those, for instance, you know, and we needed that, it's really handy to know versus, you know, trying just to do some Googling or, you know, waiting for a phone call for somebody to say, you know, I have a forklift, do you need it? For us to already know that ahead of time is a big advantage to help speed up the process for sure.
And what kind of response have you gotten so far? And what kind of response are you hoping for in the future?
We've had a very good response from a different community. Everyone we sit down and talk with has been so positive. And, you know, people understand that, you know, the idea here is to plan ahead. And people appreciate that. People like that this is being accomplished. And it's not rocket science. It's not reinventing the wheel, but is really recognizing and taking these extra steps when we don't have these disasters going on, you know, like we have this year. And anytime this there's kind of a lull in activities, you know, we're doing the best we can to get every entity out there, give it, or, you know, a community organization, a church, and individuals, really getting those people, that process in place. Because, you know, we know the next thing is out there. And then when will it happen? We don't know. But we know that because of our, you know, the different numbers we've already shared, emergencies will happen again. Disasters will happen. We will have more earthquakes. Will it be as severe or less? You know, we don't have that crystal ball, unfortunately, but we do know that it will happen. So the ability for us to prepare ahead of time, that's what we're looking to do. So we welcome, you know, these conversations with, you know, businesses and groups and churches and everyone that would say, you know what, I will want to be involved when that happens. Well, let's have that conversation now. You know, you can call the OEM office 262-4910 and, you know, let's sit down and let's have a conversation, a good cup of coffee and figure out how you would like to be involved in this process.
And planning continues on your guys' end as well for the future. So, Dan, where are we at the moment with the all-hazards mitigation plan in the borough?
So the all-hazard mitigation plan is just hopefully being finished up here. Every time we get to where we think it's done, we do find something else. So that is actually going to be up for the assembly on December 3rd. They're going to be looking at that and to officially adopt that. And that's also going through those same channels at the state and FEMA level. So for those folks that aren't aware, our mitigation plan is really something that does two things for us. If you take a look at that, which is, of course, is on our website and available to review, you know, it's going to give us the scientific basis for what we do. So essentially, that's going to be the data and the probabilities of things like, you know, what earthquakes have happened, what floods have happened, what are our probabilities, what are our hazards. But the second objective of that plan is to lay down what we want to do about it. What are some things that we can do to mitigate those disasters? And there's a lot of things in there. We went through a process here this last year on reviewing all of those projects, getting them updated, getting rid of ones that weren't practical or were completed. But it's a real key part of this. And when we talk about emergency management, you know, we've been talking a lot about preparedness. We've been talking a lot about response today and what happened. But mitigation, that lessening the impact of disasters for our community, is another key part of this. And nationwide, there's a statistic, which I like to quote because it's just really drives this point home. For every dollar we can spend on mitigation to lessen the impact, we save $6 on the response side. So it's an economic investment in our community to partner with these organizations, to partner with all levels of government, with the private sector, to put some of these things in place. So we're hoping that that mitigation plan will be approved and kind of get signed off by FEMA. It's 99% there. And then we'll be able to go forward with that for the next 5 years and work on some of those projects. And some of those things in there have been reinforced with lessons learned from this summer. And so we often spend a lot of our time, obviously, looking for funding sources and looking for ways to leverage some partnerships to accomplish that mitigation.
And give us some examples of what some of those projects are, just so folks have an idea of what, you know, mitigation looks like.
You know, so you might have different things that kind of range from really very small and easy to, you know, fairly complex legislative things. So we might have some examples of community education. So making sure that we have a presence at community events and talking about that personal preparedness aspect, because that's a key part of it. If our residents are prepared, then that's one less thing that we have to spend as an overarching response, so we can get things taken care of faster. It might be something structural. So when we're talking about you know, flood mitigation on the Eastern Peninsula, for instance, it might be let's build a water diversion structure, or let's reinforce this particular levee to try and direct water away from critical infrastructure. So it could be something physical like that, or it could be something that's legislative. And this is one to maybe review building codes. So work with our cities that have building code enforcement powers to say, are those standards good enough for public facilities mainly, but also for residential? Or do we need to look at a change? So it can run the gamut from, you know, talking about something and raising awareness to building something to regulatory change.
And you mentioned funding for these is not always just waiting to be plucked off of trees, of course.
Right.
So the so when there's an emergency disaster, often the process is, you know, the local level does what they need to do. Obviously, they're not waiting for checks to get deposited to respond. And then once something is declared an emergency, that makes you eligible for some state and federal funding. How long does that process take, though? Like, for instance, have you gotten your reimbursement from FEMA for the earthquake last year? Like, how long are you looking for anything from the Swan Lake fire?
Sure. So it depends on the extent of the disaster and also the level that it was declared. So you can have a state disaster and a federal disaster. So let's use the example of our earthquake a year ago. That was a federal disaster. If people might recall, that was declared by the president, you know, just hours after it occurred. That process, on average, for a state and federal disaster, federal takes usually a bit longer, is actually 5 to 7 years to finish a disaster and actually close it. So the borough uses its fund balance, and we keep a balance in there. Part of that minimum balance that they like to see is for emergency response. So just like you said, we write the checks, we get things done, and then we get reimbursed. So from this this particular disaster, we have received, I think, about $13,000 so far, so a pretty small amount, but we are working to get that process in. So for all of those repairs that were done about a year ago, that occurred. And to give a little bit of credit to the feds here, part of that was obviously delayed because we couldn't work on it this summer. But
you were a little busy.
We were a little busy, but it is a 5 to 7 year process. So the borough and the local governments, the cities, forward fund that. They fund that out of their own operating budget or their own reserve, and then we'll get reimbursed for it.
Well, we are coming up to the top of the hour. We've got about 3 minutes left, so I want to give you both a chance if you have any final thoughts or maybe just like a couple quick tips if people don't do anything else this weekend to be ready, what should they do? Bud, we'll start with you.
I'll tell you, Jenny, some of the things we always recommend people to do is, number one, sign up for KPB alerts on their phone, so that way we can reach out to them anytime there is an emergency or disaster, you know, such as a missing child or a senior. So if you open up your text, you know, on your phone, and in the number put in 99411, and in the body of the text where you normally type out your message, type in the letters KPB, which is for Kenai Peninsula Borough, and then just hit send. So KPB and to 99411, and then that will give you some prompts to where you can sign up and opt in, you know, for that KPB alerts message. And so you can register your, you know, landline and phones, and so no matter how you prefer to get your communication, you can be able to do that. Second thing we've already talked about, but you can go to the OEM emergency website and look for a kit, 7 to 14 days worth of supplies, a emergency kit, you know, for your home. And also you can take that same approach for your business, to be able to identify those things and how to identify how do you survive, you know, if something happens. As we've already talked about with whole community, if you're any type of an organization or business or church, and if you can answer the question, we would definitely want to help our neighbors in the middle of a disaster, then let's have a conversation now and we can get your information and contact and get an idea of the types of things you would want to be able to assist with. And so that's a 262-4910. You'd be able to call and just ask for me. And then, you know, we will have that conversation ahead of time. So, you know, it's a really, really good opportunity for that.
All right, Dan, you got about 30 seconds. And keep us all safe in 30 seconds.
Absolutely. And just the take-home message here is all of these things are all interrelated, what we've talked about this hour. And we really want to encourage the whole community to be involved in our initiative. So give Bud a call. Give us a call here at the office. And you can also visit our website. But we'll point you in the right direction.
All right. Well, Dan Nelson and Bud Sexton, thank you both so much for being here with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management. Highly recommend you take them up on all of their recommendations. This is KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. Thanks for tuning in.